Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here on a Monday morning. Monday, March the 18th, 2024, 11 and a half minutes past the hour. 29 degrees and mostly cloudy skies here in the Marion area. And we recently learned, spring pollen in the air, that the first day of spring is actually tomorrow, March the 19th. So today is the last day of winter. How about that? After all the time, you know, we don't like winter in Ohio. Now, some people will probably tell you it's their favorite season. But to be honest with you, the majority of people are just waiting for spring. But it looks as though, even though tomorrow is the first day of spring, that the temperatures for the next 4 days are going to be relatively chilly. Just over 40 degrees, I think still in the 30s today. There's another day this week, I don't have the weather forecast in front of me, that's also going to be in the 30s. So I really don't think spring is coming. Spring must be coming in like a lion. Now, it comes in like a lion when it's cold, and I think when a lamb when it's warm. I don't know how this is going to bode for Easter coming up on the 31st of this month, but I guess we'll all find out together. And as we continue on this morning, this is something we've wanted to do for a long time, because there is an author who's really got a series of books out that are very, very fascinating, certainly in this political year. Now, the newest of the books in this series is titled How Autocrats Attack Enterprise, Resistance to Trump and Trumpism. The author is UCLA law professor Richard Abel, and this hour, what a pleasure it is to be joined by him with our primaries coming up tomorrow here in Ohio. Although it doesn't mean too much in the presidential race at this point, with pretty much that being sealed up with Biden and Trump. But we are heading into the fall, and the election will be here before we know it. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones UCLA law professor Richard Abel. Richard, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Can I interrupt just and correct one mispronunciation?
Oh, go right ahead.
The book is entitled How Autocrats Attack Expertise, Not Entrepreneurs.
Oh, did I say entrepreneurs?
Yes.
Oh, my God. And it was right in front of my face, too. I had the book right in front of my face. So, expertise.
Yes.
Okay, we've got it. Well, let's start with the title here, Richard. What does that mean exactly?
Well, these three books are an attempt to construct a narrative of the Trump administration the 4 years, and to identify what I think are the most important issues that confronted the administration, and then explore the ways in which the administration dealt with them. I think everyone would agree that at the end of the day, the single most important issue that the administration confronted was the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, which began exactly 4 years ago, almost to the week now. And the question was, well, how did the Trump administration handle that? And I was interested in trying to understand the way in which the administration did or did not use experts. And I was really quite distressed to see that it sidelined the experts that were within the government, most notably Dr. Fauci, but others as well, and brought in others whose expertise was very doubtful, and who led it in what I think were unfortunate directions.
When it comes to 4 years ago, when this was all unfolding, it was the unknown, certainly for Americans of this generation. I don't think too many were left who had lived through the last pandemic. What happened inside the Trump administration that caused the most pro- it was an election year. Would it have happened if it wasn't an election year, everything that happened?
Well, yes, the election year was absolutely critical. And Trump, who, to his credit, is often very explicit about what he believes and what he's doing, often said these things must happen by a certain date because the election is coming. So he wanted approval for medications, most notably, of course, the vaccine, and he wanted that done by a certain date. But he also asked the same for other medications. So he wanted to make sure that the optics were there that would favor him in the election. And so the two are very closely tied together.
You know, Richard, I remember 2020 very well, and prior to the pandemic, it looked very good for Trump being reelected. And I even remember on election night, many, many newscasters on legitimate news stations, not commentators, saying that had the pandemic not have been there, that Trump probably would have won, and that people weren't really voting for Biden because people had to get out and campaign in a different way that year, that they were voting against Trump. And also, I remember President Trump contracting COVID not too long before the election, which I don't think certainly helped his case. Do you believe we would have had Biden if not for the pandemic?
Well, you know, these are all the what ifs of history, and nobody knows. I mean, that election was different in so many ways. For one thing, it relied necessarily on mail-in ballots and drop boxes, and that became a very controversial issue because Trump himself came out strongly against mail-in ballots. And as people remember, what happened was, and everybody had predicted this would happen, there was a red wave leading up to Election Day, and then there was a blue wave after that because the ballots that came in later, the mail ballots, favored Biden, and that's what pushed Biden over the top. And Trump, for that reason, among others, declared on election night at 2:30 in the morning he had won, and basically said, "We should not have to wait for mail ballots. Everything should be decided right now."
Which is still an issue today, even brought up in the State of the Union recently, what happened on January 6th and not accepting an election outcome. Did anybody think that it would go to the degree that it did? I mean, people don't want to lose. People are not happy sometimes with the people that they lose to. But the fact that this went on and involved so many people right up through January the 6th, did anybody see that coming? Was that the plan?
Well, I think it was the plan. I mean, again, the striking thing is that both members of the administration and very close advisors were very explicit. So that in another one of my books, How Autocrats Seek Power, I reproduce a quotation, I can't give it verbatim now, from Steve Bannon, who before the election itself said, here's what Trump is going to do, and actually wrote the playbook that Trump followed, which is he's going to say, I won, and then insist that there was fraud, and that therefore the electoral votes themselves could not be counted properly. So there was a great deal of planning. We know that people like John Eastman and Kenneth Cheesebrough were brought in, these are lawyers from the outside, were brought in early as advisors, and they suggested a plan, which indeed was the plan that Trump followed, right up through the January 6th. So indeed, there was a plan in place for what should happen if Trump lost both the popular vote, which he lost by 8 million, which I think he knew he was going to lose because he had lost the popular vote by 3 million in 2016, and the electoral vote. And so he was focused on the 5 or 6 or 7 states whose electoral vote he thought might be switched and would give him the electoral college and therefore victory.
You know, Richard, when it comes to this, I've heard a lot of people say this since 2020, that you can deny that you lost an election, you can get people to come to Washington, and unfortunately, you can get people to storm the Capitol, and you can get people to break things, and even horribly, people can die. That can all happen, but the only thing that would have stopped that election from being certified would have been if the vice president did not certify the election. So really, everything else that went on at that time, I mean, you can do all of that, and it's certainly horrible that it happens and people lost their life, but it all really came down to the vice president certifying it, did it not?
It did. And I was never a great fan of Mike Pence, but I think he did the right thing, and indeed the only thing. He had gotten advice from both inside and outside lawyers, and they said unanimously that there was no question but that he had only a ceremonial role. There was nothing else that he could do, and the things that were being proposed by people like Cheeseboro, Eastman, Clark, and others were clearly illegal and actually made no sense. The idea that a vice president whose own election was at stake could make critical decisions about how the votes would be counted is so profoundly undemocratic and so clearly unconstitutional that Pence had only one route, and he took the correct route.
Which leads me to my next question. Obviously, the storming of the Capitol did happen, and there's a lot of question to whether Trump wanted that to happen or not, or ordered it to happen. I guess we will figure that out in the courts as time goes on. But even if that had happened or did happen or would happen again, and damage is done and people are in their offices and it's horrible, but if the vice president certifies the vote, it's really all kind of irrelevant, is it not?
It is. But, of course, the purpose was either to prevent the certification from happening at all or to frighten Pence and maybe some of the other members of Congress to doing what the rioters, and I think that term is an accepted term, were demanding. And again, there wasn't a great deal of planning. It's pretty clear that, you know, there have been now more than 1,300 prosecutions of people who stormed the Capitol. All but two of them have led to conviction. That's an extraordinary conviction route. So there's really, and this is by the ordinary process of law. There's nothing political about this. This went straight through the federal courts. So there's no question about what happened, but it's also pretty clear that there was very little coordination. There were some leaders, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, who took a preeminent role, but most of the people came fairly spontaneously and did what they did. But at the end of the day, they were not able to prevent the certification from happening. And as I said, that's to the credit of Pence and the Republicans who joined the Democrats to vote for certification, although there were significant numbers in both the Senate and the House who voted against.
Certainly illegal what they did. You certainly can't storm the Capitol and riot and break things. But did they understand that the election, which I think is what was going on there, the hinging of that election, was based on the vice president, that that's really where it all was? Were they trying?
Well, there were calls to get Mike Pence. There was
right,
no question
right.
That they knew that, and of course there was this gallows that was outside, which was for symbolic reasons. I don't think they expected to hang anybody, but they did make it clear. And there were shouts of people who wanted certainly to inflict damage and maybe even to kill. It's not clear. But again, I come back to the fact. I think most of the people knew that they were there to prevent the certification from happening, and they weren't sure what was going to happen next. There were some hapless folk who didn't even know what building they were in. They thought they were in the White House. They didn't know the Capitol was where Congress met. So it was true chaos.
And prior to that day, prior to January 6th, I think it was made pretty clear by Mike Pence to President Trump that he was going to do this.
That's right. They had had several conversations, and they're on record. They were held both the night before, that was January 5th, when there was an earlier demonstration several blocks away from the White House, and then again the morning of January 6th, when they had a conversation and basically Trump said to Pence in sort of schoolboy fashion, Mike, if you don't do this, I won't be your friend anymore. And Mike said, no, this is what I have to do. There's really no question about it.
Just because it's current in the news and we're talking about Pence here, of course, the big news over the weekend was Pence says he will not endorse Trump in this election. And he says it's more about January. It's more than just about January the 6th. What do you make about what he said this past weekend?
Yeah, no, I obviously I paid good attention to that. And again, I think he gets credit for that. He did emphasize that it was rather about what he views as Trump's departure from what he, Mike Pence, believed was the Republican conservative platform. They didn't actually have a platform, but the commitments that they had made to voters, most prominently for Pence, certainly, is anti-abortion. And Trump has taken a position different from Pence on that. And I think my guess, obviously I'm not inside the minds of either of these people, but from the public record, it sounds as though that was what was moving Pence more than January 6th. It's striking that Mike McConnell, who the day after January 6th said, I will not speak to Mr. Trump ever again, has now endorsed Trump when Pence is not. So they're taking different positions, and I think Pence is the more principled.
Now, did you get the understanding, Richard, when former Vice President Pence made this statement? He said he's not going to endorse, but he didn't say he wasn't going to vote for him.
Well, he also said he would not vote for Biden. So
right.
Either he's not going to vote at all, or he may still vote for Trump. But we'll never know. The privacy of the ballot box is absolute. I doubt that Pence will announce afterwards. I say it's a brave statement because, again, I don't think this is controversial, regardless of what your politics are. Trump has the Republican Party is Trump. He basically calls the shots. If people oppose him, they are primaried, as you know, as you yourself know, that's happening in Ohio right now. And if you oppose him, your political future is very, very doubtful. McConnell, of course, is retiring. He's announced that already at the end of his term. And Pence is out of public office. He ran this time and didn't get very far and bowed out. I don't know whether he plans a future, but my guess is that he does not plan a future in politics, and that depending on what happens in 2024, if Trump wins, he will be the Republican Party, and he will call the shots for the indefinite future.
On that note, and one more current event here, just because it happened this past weekend, and it actually happened here in Ohio on Saturday, Trump said, and this is the quote, "Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country." Now, is he talking in terms, in your opinion, of literally this is what's going to happen, or is that more hyperbole?
Well, Trump is a master of ambiguity. We've seen that in his speeches now over more than 8 years. And I don't know if it's studied ambiguity or it's just confusion, but he does it very well. So he began that quote talking about the economy, and then he made it clear that he was going well beyond the economy. Because he has also said that if he is not elected, I can't give you the words, but I'm sure of the gist. If he is not elected, there will not be another election. So he has made these cataclysmic, these claims that the end of the world, the end of the United States as we know it, turns on this election, and that if he is not elected, the skies will fall and it will be the end. And that is his appeal to his electorate, to his voters.
Being here in Ohio and being in Jim Jordan's district, I mean, it's very interesting because we have a Senate race tomorrow night that's going to tell a lot of tales when it comes to President Trump. He's endorsed a candidate, and our Governor Mike DeWine, two-term governor, has endorsed another candidate. We'll see what happens there tomorrow night. But I guess the question is how did this become a thing? How did it become that Donald Trump, and a lot of people don't like Joe Biden. The polls are very close. How did it become a thing to where something like this could happen if it's so awful in America?
Well, Yeah, I mean, it goes to the central question of the origins of the support for Trump. He is, after all, a very unlikely candidate. He's a New Yorker, now a Floridian, but a New Yorker. He is the product of inherited wealth. He was a playboy. He's married three times. He's notorious about his affairs. He's not your obvious presidential candidate. Indeed, it would have been unthinkable before him that someone like him could have been a presidential candidate. So the question is, what is his appeal? And there are many people trying to answer that question. I won't suggest that I have insights beyond what they have proposed. But here are my thoughts. Trump strangely appeals to the common man. There's nothing common about him, given his wealth and his lifestyle. But he appeals to the common man. He uses ordinary language, often very vulgar language, often language that's unprintable in most newspapers, and he uses it frequently. He, for instance, most recently said of immigrants crossing the southern border, they're not people, they're animals. That's not language that you would have ever heard from a candidate before. What is it that people like about him? And the answers people give is, he says it like it is. He doesn't sound like a politician. He doesn't use carefully crafted words. Not that Biden does, but he doesn't use carefully crafted words. He speaks from his heart, maybe or not, but he speaks to our heart. I'll say one last thing, because I think we're coming to the end of my time here. What I see in Trump, and your viewers, your listeners, and yourself can think about this, is a very angry man. His face is in a perpetual scowl. That mugshot that he had to take in Georgia is classic, and it was put on coffee cups and T-shirts all over the country. It's a scowl, and his language is anger, anger, anger. Americans are uneasy. They're uncomfortable. They're afraid. Change is happening rapidly. They don't know what the future holds. And they, for many of them, anger is the appropriate response, or maybe the only response. Trump is channeling their anger. That's what I see, and I've got to say that's what I'm afraid of.
Well, we've actually got more time here, Richard. I think the interview was scheduled a little longer this morning. But and I'm glad it is, because I think it's a very interesting conversation. Because when we look at your series of books, what is your goal or purpose or hope, any of those, in writing these books?
Okay, first of all, I think it's really important that this these years be chronicled in a way that's accessible to people. And although my books are dense with fact, they're not technical. There's no, although I'm a law professor, there's no language in them that is not immediately understandable by anybody. So people shouldn't be put off by the fact that this is a law professor's book. I wanted there to be a chronicle. And I say that because some recent polling data has asked people, what do you remember about the Trump administration? And amazingly, people remember almost nothing. They remember almost nothing about the fights over immigration. They remember little about the pandemic itself. There is this amnesia, and it's not surprising. People have many other things on their minds. They're busy. They get the most of their information is about the most current events, not about what happened 4 years ago or 8 years ago. So I wanted there to be a chronicle. Secondly, I wanted people to understand what Trump was able to do and what he was unable to do. So let me just mention some of those things briefly. He made the center point of his first administration, and has made it clear that it will be the center point of his second administration, anti-immigrant policies. And he said that openly. He said it again. He says, on day one, when I want to be a dictator, I will simply close the border. Nobody will cross it. I would say two things about that. It is clearly illegal, clearly unconstitutional. There is a right of asylum, which is embedded in our laws and our treaties, which cannot be eradicated by the say-so of the president. So you can't do it legally, and you can't do it physically. It's a very long border, and he built the wall only along a fraction of it. Even that wall, people have gone over and under and around. So that can't happen. That is the center point of his campaign. Okay, so what did he do? Well, he tried to do just that in the first 90 or several hundred days of his administration. He came in and he enacted the first Muslim ban. He simply banned entry from a number of Muslim-majority countries. And not surprisingly, that was struck down because it was clearly unconstitutional. And so he enacted a second Muslim ban, and that was struck down because it was clearly unconstitutional. And in fact, of all of the actions that he took to control or limit or constrict immigration, all but the third Muslim ban was struck down. He did all of those by executive order because Republicans did not control those houses of Congress. And I suspect that will be the case regardless of what happens in the presidency in 2024 and the next 4 years. And the court said what you're doing is illegal. I would add in the side, because this is still the case, part of the reason for that is that he was being given very bad legal advice, and some of that legal advice was coming from Stephen Miller, who is his principal administration advisor. Stephen Miller is not a lawyer. Stephen Miller believes he can understand the law, but he does not, and he gave very bad legal advice, and for that reason, each of those bans was struck down. Now, Trump responded to that in an interesting way, because it set a pattern that he has followed, again, not only in his 4 years in office, but in his 4 years out of office, which is when he loses, and you say nobody likes to be a loser, but he least of all likes to be a loser, when he loses, he strikes back at what he thinks is the person who is responsible. In this case, it's the courts. So he attacked the courts. He referred to so-called judges. He referred to Democrat judges. He referred to Mexican judges when they were, of course, Americans. His attorney general referred to a judge who happens to be sitting on an island in the Pacific. Well, that island is Hawaii, which has been a state of the union now for over half a century. So he lashed out at the courts. He did that again when his advisors were being prosecuted for alleged collusion with Russia. And most importantly, he's been doing that again in each of the lawsuits he's been involved in. He attacked Judge Engoron, who entered a judgment against him for $500 million. He attacked Judge Merchan, who is going to be hearing the Stormy Daniels case. He attacked the judge in D.C., Chutkan, who is going to hear the election case. And, of course, he attacked the judge in Georgia. The prosecutor in Georgia, Fannie Willis, who is prosecuting him for the election case. So he attacks the institutions. I've got to say, as a lawyer, I was a law professor for over 40 years and helped to produce many future lawyers. I find that just terrifying. You can't attack courts and expect the nation to survive. If people do not trust the courts, we do not have a functioning legal system, and we do not have a functioning democracy. So that is the way he responds, and I find it very frightening. I'll give you one other example. He has said, and this is on the record multiple times, he is going to free the January 6th defendants. He calls them hostages, he calls them patriots, and he's going to free them. That is what he did to his cronies when they were convicted for collusion with Russia, or for lying to the FBI, or for concealing information, or for not filing taxes, or for whatever. He pardoned them. And he's going to use the pardon power, which is absolutely unlimited, to free all of them. Some of them are guilty of assaulting police officers, some of whom died. It's just inconceivable that a president would feel that it is right to use his power in that way. And it places the entire legal system in jeopardy.
Richard, I want to come back to two points here, especially one in regard to the legal system here. When it comes to the point that you made, attacking these courts and prosecutors and judges, why do the judges not issue gag orders or stop this from happening if it is so harmful?
Well, that's a great question, and it's rather technical. I'm not sure I have a full answer, so I'm going to give a somewhat vague answer. The gag orders that have been issued, and Judge Kaplan issued one in the E. Jean Carroll case, and Judge Engoron issued one, and Judge McAfee has issued one, and Judge Marchand has indicated that he will issue one, and even Cannon down in Florida has issued one. So there have been gag orders, but they have been very carefully couched. So they have said you cannot interfere with witnesses, which is absolutely true. You cannot talk to or about witnesses. You cannot issue threats that other people may carry out, because indeed that is exactly what has happened. When Trump denounces people, other people carry out the threats and either stalk or send hate mail or do even worse to witnesses. So that is clearly legal and clearly mandated if you're going to have a fair trial. But the judges have said, you can criticize me, the judge, if you want, because you are running for president and you should have the ability, the free speech right, to say what you want to say about the courts. And that's somewhat of a close call, but I think the judges are doing the right thing in erring on the side of free speech.
We've got about 15 minutes left here this morning with Richard Abel, UCLA law professor, author of the book, How Autocrats Attack Expertise, Resistance to Trump and Trumpism. It's part of a series of books here. And Richard, the other question, the dictator comment. Now, this came up from the second that Trump made it. This has been something that the Democrats have been using against him, that this is the end of democracy if Trump is elected, so on and so forth. But a lot of people have said that there still will be a Senate, there still will be a Congress, and even if it is a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate, that having a dictator is not going to be good for them because it would be the end of their power. Is this really an election that hinges on the end of democracy and a possible dictator?
Well, you know, that is exactly what my books are about. Let me just, if I can, just mention the titles of the other two books. So the book that you mentioned first is How Autocrats Attack Expertise, which is about the pandemic. The other two books are How Autocrats Seek Power, which is about the 2016 election and the 2020 election, and therefore in anticipation of the 2024 election, and then How Autocrats Abuse Power, and that's primarily about immigration and about the criminal justice system. Trump has said he wants to be dictator, and then he said, but only for a day. But he has said at other times, he has said, I don't feel bound by the laws. We are in a crisis situation. I don't feel that I have to obey the laws. I don't feel I have to obey the Constitution. He has threatened to use powers. He certainly contemplated it in the 2020 election. Mike Flynn and Sidney Powell and others said to him, Mr. President, you have the power under the Insurrection Act to declare an emergency, and then you can order the military to seize the election machines and to have either a recount or simply to call for a re-election. The idea that a president can unilaterally nullify an election by invoking emergency powers is, I think, as close to a dictatorship as we can come. And were Trump to do that, I think we would have to acknowledge it is a dictatorship. And that is something that even Republicans, were they motivated to do so in the Senate and in the House, could do nothing about, because the law is on the books. The emergency powers exist under the Insurrection Act.
If Trump is elected in November, he doesn't immediately take office. He wouldn't take office until January 20th. If there was a real belief that this was the end of democracy and that the certification of that election was going to give you a dictator, would the Democratic administration really go along with that just to be ceremonial?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. So it was an interesting article in the New York Times by Ezra Klein recently, in which he said, Republicans play to win, Democrats play by the rules of the game. That's got to change. I've got to disagree with Mr. Klein. I don't think that is either likely to happen or that it should happen. The rules of the game are the rules of the game. I was listening to a wonderful Philip Roth book on tape on my drive recently called The Great American Novel, which is really about the great American game, namely baseball. It's all about how baseball has to be played by the rules of the game. And baseball is a great metaphor for American democracy. You can't have a democracy unless there are rules. The rules are there in the Constitution and the laws that have been passed, and then in their interpretations by the courts. That's how the system has to work. If you nullify that, we have a dictatorship. there are plenty of dictatorships out there, and there are plenty of people in the world who seem to want dictatorships. We know what's going to happen in the election in Russia when Putin wins, and the same is true for countries elsewhere. I'm just hoping that Americans don't want a dictatorship, because if they want one, they're going to get one.
You know, it becomes an interesting story in history, though, because, as I said, if that is truly what you believe, and that Trump is going to be a dictator, and this is the end of democracy, and you've essentially got 2 months in before that happens, you just sit there and wait for it to happen, even though you could stop it just because that's the way we've always done things?
Well, remember that in that lame duck Congress and presidency, Republicans still control the House, and Democrats barely control the Senate. So there isn't a lot that Democrats can do in the legislature, and there isn't a great deal that can be done in the presidency. You know, after the January 6th, there were two efforts to change the way we do elections. One was to change the Electoral Count Act so that the kinds of things that were being demanded of Vice President Pence could not be demanded again. And that act passed, and it passed with a handy support from Republicans. But there was a second act that was being proposed to make elections fairer and to ensure the widest possible, the most comprehensive electorate. And that failed because Republicans turned it down. I think that at the end of the day, there are no short-term solutions to the problems of America. I think that solutions are long-term solutions. I think they are an electorate that is truly representative of the entire American people, so that everybody who is entitled to vote actually can cast that ballot. And then the engagement that is required by Americans so that they cast their ballot. There are countries that get 80 and 90% of the electorate voting. America, even in an election year, rarely gets above 50%. And people are disengaged. Most people do not stay current with what's happening in the world, and people do not turn out to vote. It really is in the hands of the electorate to educate themselves and to exercise that absolutely essential right.
In our final 10 minutes, I want to come back to COVID, the pandemic, here in just a second. But I do want to ask this question, because we started by talking about how Mike Pence had the power not to certify the last election, which would have caused a lot of problems for a lot of people, January 6th, so on and so forth. If it came down to this, and again, almost repeating myself here, if you really believe Trump was going to be a dictator, and I'm not saying that that's what will happen or is going to happen, but if you believe that and you lose the election, it comes to Kamala Harris, the vice president. Is she going to go down in the history books as the person who certified the election that gave you a dictator?
I think she will. I don't think she has a choice. Remember that the law is actually quite complicated. But if the Electoral College vote is unsuccessful for a variety of reasons, including that there is no single majority candidate, which could happen, given that there will be at least one third-party candidate, RFK Jr., and maybe more. So it could be a situation in which there is no one wins a majority of the electoral votes. If that's the case, then the laws require that Congress vote, in which each state has one vote, and the state's vote is decided by the state legislature. That was one of the outcomes that Trump had wanted in 2020, in 2021, because, as he said repeatedly, Republicans control a majority of state legislatures, and that's still true. Depending on how you count it, it's roughly 26 to 22 or maybe 28 to 22, but there's no question but that it's a majority. So that if certification were not to happen, then Congress would be the decisive body, but it would be by one vote, one state, which, by the way, is a very undemocratic way of voting, because it pairs a state like Wyoming against a state like California, where the populations are dramatically different. But nevertheless, that's what the law requires. Then again, I think, given that Republicans will back Trump, he would be elected.
Want to come back to the pandemic here in our final 10 minutes. I think this is very important. We heard the Woodward tapes. Legendary journalist Bob Woodward was doing a book on Trump at the time and had audio tapes and released them, in which Trump is saying, then President Trump is saying, yes, I know how bad this is going to be. This is going to be awful. And it's just going to be horrible. He was aware of what was coming and what was going on. Why did he take the route that he did?
Well, again, it's very much like what he did. I want to come back to the pandemic in a second. It's very much what he did in December, November, December, and then early January 2021. He knew, and this has been repeated over and over again, because all his advisors were telling him, he knew that he had lost. Meadows told him that, Pence told him that, his statisticians told him that, Barr told him that, everybody told him that, except for the few people like Flynn and Powell, and especially Giuliani, who were telling him otherwise. So, but he knew. There was really no question about that. But he also believed that he could shape reality. He didn't believe there was a reality. He believed that he had the power to change it. So he thought if he simply kept saying, I won, I won, I won, he would win. He felt the same way about the pandemic. He thought he could, if pardon the pun, he could trump science. He could substitute his own words for science, and he would do that in ways that would help him in, he believed would help him in the election. So, for instance, he made a center point of his approach to the pandemic, the fact that it originated in China. Now, there's no question but that it originated in China, in the city of Wuhan. So he called it the China virus, the Wuhan virus, and then, of course, the Kung flu. So he wanted to mobilize anti-immigrant sentiment, and especially anti-Chinese sentiment, which goes back a century in American history, and which he had fueled, to try to blame China for the virus. Well, you know, blaming is not really helpful. The question is, what can we do to prevent it from spreading? He said, well, I've solved the problem by closing the borders. But since he had waited to close the borders, he did not solve the problem. And by the time he closed the borders, it was pointless because it was already firmly implanted in the United States. He did other things. He, for instance, said, I don't want the people on the cruise ship who are infected to be allowed to land, because then we have to count them among the number of cases, and I don't want the case numbers to go up. So he left the people on the ships, and I can't say this with certainty, but we know ships are a breeding ground, and these were elderly people, and many of them may have contracted COVID, which would not have happened had they been allowed to disembark. He insisted that it was the testing that was producing the number of cases, when all of his epidemiologists and all the public health scientists said, we have to test because we have to know how many cases there are, where they are rising, and what we can do to prevent them from spreading. But he came out against testing for that reason. He came out against masking because he didn't like the looks of masks. He said, I won't wear a mask sitting behind the Resolute desk when I meet kings, queens, and dictators because I don't like the way it looks. And he himself attended the event, which was the Barrett, I think it was the Barrett celebration for her confirmation, which was a super spreader, which is how he got COVID and undoubtedly spread it to other people as well. And then, of course, he promoted hydroxychloroquine because he had heard about it on Fox News, which was the source of all of his information, even though the CDC, after they did all the appropriate studies, decided, A, it was ineffective, and B, it was potentially toxic. And then, of course, most notoriously, in a televised press conference, he urged people to ingest bleach, and some people did, and some people died as a result. So he really believed that he could orchestrate nature, because he's Donald Trump, with disastrous results.
Richard, with about 4 minutes left to go here, do you have any more books planned? This is an election year before November.
Not before November, but I am, to my dismay, writing a fourth book, which I will finish right after the election, and it's going to be called How Autocrats Are Held Accountable, although I should probably put a question mark at the end of that. And it's going to follow two tracks. It's going to follow all the efforts to hold Trump accountable beginning immediately after January 6, 2021, and it's going to follow all the efforts during the election. Let me focus on the first, because people are going to be thinking about the election for the future. So I look at first the second impeachment, where I think that the Democrats put on a devastating case for impeaching Trump, and of course succeeded in doing so in the House of Representatives, but not surprisingly, since Republicans had enough votes to prevent a two-thirds vote in the Senate, the Senate did not vote to convict. And I've got to say, I think it is really shocking that the Republicans voted against conviction in that case. I can't imagine a clearer example of the impeachment process. Then there was the attempt to hold an impartial, bipartisan January 6th commission, and the Republicans prevented that, first by refusing to have an impartial commission, and secondly by proposing that the Republican representatives be people who were themselves implicated in January 6th. Then there was a January 6th special select committee itself, where it's with its hearings, which were extraordinarily dramatic. But at the end of the day, only 8% of the American public watched those hearings, and they did not apparently change their view as a result of that. So what do we have left? Well, we have the following. We have the criminal cases, which I've been reading with in great detail. More than 1,300 of them, the largest criminal prosecution around a single event in American history. And what I find most interesting about it is the following. All the cases were tried in the District of Columbia District Court, which has a large number of judges nominated by both Republican and Democratic presidents. So I looked to see whether there were differences in the ways in which the judges handled the cases, depending on whether they had been nominated by a Democrat or Republican, which is pretty much a proxy for their own political orientation. And there was none. I ran the numbers. There was no significant difference in the way the judges performed. Why is that so significant? Because I did the same for the way in which the judges handled the cases during the Trump administration around the pandemic. These were cases about pandemic prevention measures, around immigration, around criminal justice, and especially around the election. When I ran the numbers there, again, comparing the judge's likely political affiliation, depending on whether he or she had been appointed by a Republican or a Democrat, and whether the judge favored or voted against the Trump administration, the correlation was 0.00001. For those who are not statistically inclined, and that would include me, I will give you what that means in more layman terms. That means the probability that the correlation between politics and outcome is a chance event is 1 in 100,000. Those are pretty good odds. If you wanted to bet at Vegas and you those were your odds, you would not bet against that. So the striking thing is that the judges handling criminal cases, ordinary criminal cases, although it was an extraordinary event, did so the way judges should do so. And I found that very encouraging. And I would hope that judges will continue to do so in the future.
Richard, final question here today, and I think it's just first I want to give the title of the book again here, How Autocrats Attack Expertise, A Resistance to Trump and Trumpism. Richard Abel is the author, and again, this is part of a series of books. But for people who say, for a lot of people who support Donald Trump, who say this is just a liberal college professor who doesn't want to see Trump elected, what do you say to those people?
Well, they're absolutely right. They're right about all of those words. But I think they should think seriously about whether they want somebody in the Oval Office who has said, I don't believe I am bound by the Constitution. I don't believe I am bound by the election. I don't believe there will be another election if I don't win. Is that who you want in the Oval Office? That is not a partisan issue. I think that's an issue for everyone.
Richard Abel, it's been a very interesting conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. All right, well, there you go. For this particular day, this is Scott Spears headed for the dugout. Just listen to former star of The Jeffersons and 227, Marla Gibbs.
Where did the name